I want to just sort of shift a little to the election and ask
Okay.
you, I mean, where do you see problematic conversations happening? Where do you see any good ones happening? Would be better. Maybe a shorter interview if we went on that. Just how are issues of systemic racism showing up for you in the election, in the campaigns?
Oh my goodness, right? So yeah, you're right. Like we could go on ad nauseum about where it's showing up. It's showing up everywhere. Two places kind of jump out at me as being important to name. And one is it's showing up in the way the electoral campaigns run themselves, right? And so when I say that, I'm talking about just all of electoral politics in the United States, and particularly kind of the two big parties, the DNC and the RNC. And I'm looking at the choices that are being made for who will represent us, what their platforms are, what strategies are used to get people to the polls, whether or not we seek to change the electoral map. For example, one thing that jumps out at me is that this should be a runaway election for Hillary Clinton. Because she's running against someone who is just so far beyond the pale that he shouldn't even be a viable consideration. And so then, Democrats poke fun at Republicans. Oh, they're dumb, they're stupid, they're bigots, they're this, they're that, right? And that bigotry is real, right? But what I do, what I look at is, why is our things so close? First off, these folk aren't dumb, right? They're appealing to some real or perceived needs that are being expressed by particular people. And those people are coming out to vote. But those needs don't represent all of the country. But here's the problem. You go to a place like Georgia, where Georgia elections in Georgia, whether Georgia is a blue state or a red state, is determined by about 100, somewhere between 150,000 and 200,000 votes. All the DNC would have to do is register 200,000 people, 250,000 people who are not registered to vote. And if they choose to do this voter registration campaigning in communities of color, 90 some odd percent of those people are going to vote Democratic for the Democratic Party. So why isn't that happening in Georgia as a massive push from the top of the Democratic Party? From what I understand, Texas elections are decided by about 900,000 votes. So it's a red state by about 900,000 votes. Well, apparently there are 3 million, count them, 3 million. That's more than three times the number of folk who decide elections in Texas. There are 3 million eligible Latino voters who have not been registered. What is that? How is that not the thing to be about? In my analysis, the only reason can be that somehow either white votes are being privileged as being the only important votes, or people are running from the inevitable shifts in power that occur when you add more people to the system. Same thing happens in terms of how money is spent around whether we're going to do television ads or we're going to do get out the vote door-to-door knocking. The same white male primarily consultants are hired to do that work, to advise the campaign on what strategies to use where, and they come back to the table, say, hey, we need to do these commercials on these in these spaces at Nissan slots. Well, why? Because they make 15% on those buys. So every time $1 million is spent on a television commercial, $150,000 or so is goes in the pocket of these same consultants who know nothing about this group of people who could vote but aren't likely voters, and so they don't put any efforts towards it. If the same money were spent on grassroots efforts, you'd get more voters into the system, but these same people who have been in power wouldn't get paid the same way. And so,
right.
Even though every single scholarly study that's ever been done on commercials and political times says that it's a waste of money, we still put that money, the same people, the same primarily white people, overwhelmingly white people, who run the political organizations, keep making the same decisions and keep getting the same results, and even to the point of risking losing. That's racism.
That is, I mean, it's an excellent point to say that if you empower people, bring them into the system by registering to them to vote, they ain't always going to vote the way you want them to either, you know, because
exactly. Or they're going to make demands.
Pardon me?
Or they're going to make demands, right? They're going to require something. Right?
Yes.
Like you know. What's ludicrous to me is that Hillary Clinton, as much as she's the only even if it's between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, there is no possible way that on this rational face you can arrive at, yeah, Donald Trump. But Hillary Clinton would rather risk losing.
Yeah.
Then say, hey, I'm going to bring these new people in, and then I'm going to convince them to get excited about voting for me by giving them the things that matter to them. So the economic plan put forth by BY100, right? Check that out if you've never seen it, right? This is saying this is an economic plan that would benefit people of color in this country and help correct some of the wrongs that have historically been done. The Campaign Zero is a plan for how to remedy or begin to remedy some the problems around state-sponsored or state-sanctioned, not state-sponsored, but state-sanctioned murder of people of color by police. Right? Mm. She hasn't said, yeah, that's what I'm gonna do. She hasn't said, hey, let me look at this Black Lives Matter platform and see what parts of it we can incorporate. No commitments have been made there. No commitments to block grants and for institutions and communities of color. No particular commitments to the small businesses run by minority small businesses supported by the SBA. Nothing. She has offered nothing.
Yeah.
To say, get excited about me. That again,
yeah,
is part of the racism, because the assumption is, well, you might as well vote for us.
Yeah,
we're better than the other guy. Forget what matters to you.
Yeah,
we're your only option.
Yeah, it's not. It begins to feel like you say that people would rather risk losing than risk sharing power. You talk about you tell a compelling story in Better about your experience of rarely finding white men. You indict white men. Phew, let me off the hook there. You indict white men, but they travel in packs and they rarely give up power. I found that really interesting because, I know a lot of white liberal men who believe in their hearts that they are sharing power and willing to share power, but maybe they're not succeeding in a way that they're imagining.
Well, you know, we have this thing about this notion of, and we try not to use language of tokenism, right? But it's this tokenism, right? As long as there is a black face involved or an Asian face involved, or then we've shared power.
Right.
And that's not how that works. Like, you know, we live in a country where only 62% of the people in the country now, and it's probably less than that, are white people. That means close to 40, if not 40% of the country already are people of color,
mm-hmm.
which means, like, stuff. If power sharing is happening, right, then resources should be channeled across that spectrum
yeah.
in proportional ways. If power sharing is happening, then decision making should be channeled across that spectrum in proportional ways, within reasonably proportional ways, right? And so on and so forth. So yeah, there's a difference between actually sharing power and talking about sharing power.
Yeah. Yep, because actually doing it would mean giving up some power. I mean, it would mean stepping off stage for a minute or into the back, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I thought that was
very,
you know, it's funny because we have a, not to get too off track, but we have a friend, Michael Kerwin, who's a priest thinking really hard about what's happening in the Catholic Church and wondering how white male priests can get out of the way of the work that the Spirit is doing, renewing the church from global renewal that's going place. And white men tend to be a little resistant to the work of the Spirit. But anyway, it's that notion of if you're in a position of power, there's really very little motivation to let go. Aside from
absolutely.
One, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, that you know, and I think really we need to talk more honestly about how invested certain people are in certain things, right? Like, you know, I grew up in a church where they talked about the headship of men. You know, men were the leaders and meant to be leaders, and God ordained men to be leaders. Well, you know, if you grow up in a male-dominated space, then it's easy to get invested in your turn to participate in that power dynamic. And so you find yourself, whether consciously or unconsciously, kind of just not kind of working against any change in that paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. And even if quite often, you know, we'll say, well, yeah, women are a part of this thing, but they find themselves answering to men for the choices they make, right? Right. And so that same kind of thing, that interrogation of power becomes deeply important. And part of what makes racism racism is we're talking about power being leveraged. Power being leveraged. And you can't have a conversation about dismantling racism without talking about changing the way power is leveraged and who gets to leverage it.
Yeah.
If we have that going on in the political election right now, one of the other things that would be different would be the terms that we use to talk about things. Now, I started jotting down certain terms right now. You know, this isn't about whether a person is lying or not. We have a lot of just outright lying.
Mm-hmm.
Within the election, right? Folk who say things and then say, I didn't say that, right? and even though we live in an age where everything gets recorded and everything gets kept, it's not like it disappears, right? It's still, it's like I didn't say it, I'm gonna stick with it. So it's that old Saturday Night Live, that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah.
So I'm not talking about the lying that happens within the election. what lets me know that racism is alive and well in the language that's being used and that power hasn't shifted or isn't being shared is just the language constructs that people come up with. Like, so you have this language from one party that says, make America great again. And of course, any person of color is going to look at that and say, so when was America great? Tell me what time we want to go back to. Because I'll tell you that more than likely, my story was on the losing end of that greatness, mm-hmm. not on the participation in that quote-unquote greatness, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But the other side isn't a whole lot better. Like, they use this language of better together, right? Better together, which you know, on its face sounds really good. Like, I'm all for better. I got a book named Better. But when you heard it framed at the Democratic National Convention, there was this particular kind of ahistorical framing that was just aggravating for anyone who's a person of color and knows history, right? Because it was, we have always been a nation that believed we are better together. When was that? Right, like the Revolutionary War isn't us always being a nation. The Civil War isn't us always being a nation. What happened to soldiers of color who went and fought World War One or World War Two? That doesn't tell that story, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, the enslavement of black people. You know, when we're talking about trillions of dollars of wealth being created on this thing, that doesn't speak to we have always been a nation that understood we are better together, right? Yeah. The first anti-immigration laws written against Asian Americans does not speak of that, right? The war we picked with Mexico to steal Kansas and Utah and Texas and California and New Mexico and Arizona from then Mexico, and then the letting the Mexicans who were now on this side of the border stay, and then running them out, and then calling them back, and then running them out, and then calling them back. And that doesn't speak to a country mm-hmm. that has always believed we are better together. So both sides use language mm-hmm. that shows that there are not people
yeah.
from all swaths, all communities, who are able to speak into what is the language that speaks to the truth about who we are,
right.
what we need to do to work on, and who we want to be.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that historical amnesia or whatever, blindness, I feel for you, Melvin. I can only imagine how frustrating that's got to be, to have to sit and listen to that from people who say they've got your best interests at heart, no less. You know, that's got to be very frustrating. Which sort of brings me to something I also wanted to talk with you about, which is sort of two things that are coming together for me, which is how you do impact these narratives that seem to just keep perpetuating the bad stories about who we are, that are either incomplete or just outright lies, with the history of things.